Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. Today, we'll be continuing with our exploration of alternative healing practices. Chiropractic, what can it do for us? We're going to take a look at some of the articles and issues have been brought up about how chiropractic is not scientific. Once again, after almost 20 years of progress and fighting, the forces of established medicine who had denigrated chiropractic, there was a brief reprieve. Now it seems as if they're rolling back all that progress. Then we're going to look at cancer. Cancer and herbs. On Sunday's 60 Minutes, there were two women, both with terminal cancer, both who had tried surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy repeatedly. Both had seen their cancers reappear, and they were getting worse. They were trying to get an experimental drug, and they were willing to be human guinea pigs. My question is, I was watching these women who seemed to be extremely capable, sincere, and resourceful, was, were they even aware? Had anyone brought up to them that there are non-toxic and natural approaches to the cancers they have, colorectal cancer, metastasis to the liver, that have people alive and well? Clearly, that was not the point of the exercise. So I would like to share today how I would have approached this problem if I were either of those women. And maybe that might get out to them that there are natural approaches. And where I will also give the scientific basis for these to show you that these are reasonable. And I'll go to that in a moment. Let me also mention, when many of you probably tuned in on Sunday evening at 8 o'clock to my WNEW show, and I was not there. Simply stated, the engineer for the satellite company forgot. And so I was not heard all over the United States. I can assure you that person won't be making that mistake again. But we were on WEBD at 9 o'clock. These things happen. And so we're back on regular time, 8 to 9, 102.7 FM, WNEW, 9 to 10, WVD 1050 AM on the dial. Let's now go to some of the latest in health update information. For those of you who've told that Ginkgo really doesn't do a whole lot, well, not according to the American Academy of Neurology, because they have found that Ginkgo biloba, which many of you are using, can help limit brain damage caused by a stroke. Researchers reported that Ginkgo reduces the extent of brain damage caused by artificially induced strokes. And strokes occur when blood flow to the brain is disrupted by either a blocked artery or bleeding. This reduced blood supply can damage or even kill brain tissue, your neurons. Now, depending upon the part of the brain involved, people are often left with such disabilities such as paralysis, speech problems, confusion, and memory lapses. So now we know that ginkgo, vitamin E, EPA, and DHA all work together to protect against this abnormal tendency of the body to form clots and helps improve microcirculation to the brain. And as you can get oxygen and blood into the brain, you're going to help yourself. That's good news. From the American Academy of Neurology, this is April 29th to May 6th issue, year 2000. Active life helps ward off Alzheimer's. And I'll quote, keeping active outside of work, either physically or mentally, in the middle of years, 40 to 60, may help prevent Alzheimer's disease. Researchers found that people with higher levels of non-occupational activity, such as playing a musical instrument, gardening, physical exercise, or even playing board games, were less likely to develop Alzheimer's disease later in life. People who were less active were more than 300% more likely to have Alzheimer's disease. And the study is the first to examine the levels of activity from at least 5 years before Alzheimer's symptoms appeared. So that's good. Also good, the New England Journal of Medicine. In a recent issue, high fiber diet for type 2 diabetes. For years, there was a statement, official statement, that fiber had nothing to do with diabetes, wouldn't affect the blood sugar at all. Now we know, not true. A very high intake of dietary fiber, mostly from fruits and vegetables, lowers blood glucose levels in diabetics. In a study of individuals, those who included 50 grams, that's what I've been suggesting you have, that's what everyone in a health support group has, of fiber in their daily diet, had an enormous advantage in lowering their glucose levels. The average American consumes only about anywhere from 8 grams to about 17 grams of fiber a day. And the fibers are best if they're from fruit. And yet for years we were told that fruit had no capacity to do anything as a fiber. Well, now they're recognizing it does. So they're suggesting cantaloupe, grapefruit, oranges, papayas, raisins, and vegetables like sweet potatoes, winter and squash and zucchini, and oatmeal, okra. So for those of you who've been doing this all along, good for you. Think of the advantage you have with your health today. Let's go to another area. And this area concerns the omega-3 fatty acids. In a recent study that we are actually concluding this evening, in fact, today and tomorrow, we are having a graduation of people who have completed the first major stage, the first 6 months of a health program, and we have people do an evaluation of blood pressure. Well, a lot of the people had it done yesterday, and the results were just spectacular. So many people are now off their medications. Their doctor, their primary care physician, has taken them off because they no longer need the medications. I've seen blood pressure drop more with lifestyle change in individuals who've committed themselves to a really healthy life than any medication that I'm aware of could do. I'm hoping that this illustrates to physicians and nurses and people within the health field that they may want to start to consider, I'm not asking anyone to make that big jump from a drug-based therapy to a natural-based therapy, but even to start to encourage their patients to use more natural and healthy diet to see if then the requirements for the medication can be reduced. Then if the doctor's suggesting, okay, start taking garlic, start taking some of the omega-3 fatty acids, if the doctor begins to see in that patient that the blood pressure is coming down over a period, let's say, of 6 months, to where they're one half the medication or less, then that's good because then the doctor will start using it on other patients. And that's what we want to see, because we have 55 million Americans with high blood pressure who are on medications. Probably another close to 50 million, I'm going to guess, who have high blood pressure either don't know it or are not on medications. So this is good news. Now, this article comes from a mainstream peer-reviewed journal. In fact, one of theirs, Atherosclerosis, volume 47, page 187. And it's an article entitled, "The Influence of Low Intake of Omega-3 Fatty Acids on Platelets in Elderly People," by Dr. Vaselli and Associates. And what they did is they took a group of elderly, healthy individuals, age 70 to 83, were randomly assigned to receive either a double-blind, placebo-controlled, 150 milligram of DHA, or 30 milligrams of EPA, and or a placebo. People didn't know what they were getting. And what they found is when they finished the study, the people who were taking the placebo, no change in blood pressure. The people taking the DHA and the EPA, substantial change for the better in the blood pressure. So lipid peroxidation, which is very dangerous, which is a primary killer of senior citizens, that is very bad. So this shows us something as simple, just one single item, something as inexpensive. And by the way, the omega-3 fatty acids are very inexpensive. You could get a month's supply for about $6. We're talking about something that can help save a life of a senior citizen because it can significantly reduce the systolic blood pressure and decrease the amount of oxidative stress. And in the elderly, the elevated systolic blood pressure may even be more important than the diastolic, hypertension, as a risk factor for total and cardiovascular mortality. So that's good news, inexpensive. Now, one other good news for everyone who cares about their heart, and this comes from the Annals of Internal Medicine, Volume 132, page 538. Eating walnuts, just a handful of walnuts, lowers your serum cholesterol. 55 men and women, the average age was 56, with hypercholesterolemia, were randomly assigned a cholesterol-lowering Mediterranean diet, or a diet similar energy and fat content in which walnuts replaced approximately 35% of the energy obtained from the fat. After 6 weeks, the patients consume the other diet for additional 6 weeks. And they had olive oil in the Mediterranean diet, of course, but no nuts. And on the walnut diet, they found the following. The results showed that substituting walnuts for the fats in a regular cholesterol diet was able to reduce the bad LDL cholesterol substantially. And that's very good because consider this. Most Americans don't eat nuts. Most women don't eat nuts because concerns about fat. This showed that you can reduce the overall fat in the diet by substituting it with walnuts, which has a healthy fat. So we shouldn't fear fat. Fat's a very important and essential nutrient. That's where our hormones are created. I mean, estrogen is created from fat. Your sex hormones are created from fat. Your libido is based upon fat. Most of the dry matter of your brain is fat. Your immune system is also composed of fat. The cells are protected by a fatty sheath. So when we go depriving ourselves of fat, we're adversely affecting our whole health. But walnuts, 5 ounces of walnuts a day, or excuse me, a week, lowers cholesterol, helps your heart, good for your joints. That's terrific. And that comes from the Annals of Internal Medicine. I'm Gary Nall. Just sharing some of the latest in health and nutrition updates, showing you that the simple, seemingly of no consequence things you would do really have a major consequence. And so we should just keep doing it. And the more we do, the healthier we're going to be. Let's say hello to my first guest. He was on about, I'm going to guess, 3 months ago, Dr. Martin Gallagher. He's been practicing clinical nutrition and chiropractic for 26 years, he is the clinical director of Medical Wellness Associates in Gannett, Pennsylvania. And he's the author of Dr. Gallagher's Guide to 21st Century Medicine. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Gary. Nice to be back with you.
When you were on last, I read you an article about the man considered the most significant or important alternative educator, physician in England, and how he was really down on chiropractic and had almost made it a point to go on a concerted effort to show that chiropractic had no basis in science and therefore really was not serving the public interest and therefore people shouldn't really rely upon it. The man's name was Dr. Ernst, E-R-N-S-T, and he stated also that alternative diets, homeopathy, ozone therapy, herbal treatments also in this case, had absolutely nothing to offer cancer patients. I'd like your position on that, since you had a chance to do some homework.
Well, Gary, I have done quite a bit of homework, and I've taken a look at the journals of which Dr. Ernst has published information regarding complementary and alternative medicine, particularly relative to chiropractic treatment and herbal medicine and homeopathy and acupuncture and the various types of diets that are being used with cancer patients and also non-cancer patients. And I'd have to say, after reviewing these articles at length, Dr. Ernst has used selective information from the scientific studies to foster his point of view. And that point of view happens to be that there is scant information in reference to chiropractic manipulation for conditions like back pain and headaches and neck pain, that there is scant information regarding the use of herbal medicine, both single herbs as well as multiple herbs, such as Chinese herbal medicine, and the use of cancer and headaches and anxiety and depression, that homeopathy, the concept of like curing like, has minimal scientific basis to it, and although not harmful, has no significant therapeutic effect, as well as the concept of using high amounts of dilution. His point of view is that when you dilute a substance, a homeopathic substance, that there's nothing left, so how could you possibly have a therapeutic effect? Now, on the other hand, I think what we have is a bit of a maverick going out with his particular point of view and then using partial science, selective science, to prove his particular opinion. And I think that's pretty easy to do. We see that quite a bit in science today, or what we call science, where people have selective memory regarding the actual studies that take place on heart disease or cancer or diabetes to prove their point of view. Actually, the British Medical Association regards acupuncture, chiropractic, herbalism, homeopathy, and osteopathy as the five most developed complementary alternative medicine disciplines, and those with the potential for greatest use alongside orthodox medical care. So I really, based on the current information in which Dr. Ernst has basically said that all these forms of alternative therapy don't have a strong scientific basis, that they should be used very minimally or very selectively, and with potential risk associated with the people using them, really just demonstrates his own particular bias. The British Medical Association as a whole, as well as most of the current medical associations throughout the world, are embracing the idea of alternative medicine because it really represents what we refer to as traditional natural health care. Herbal medicine has survived the test of time because it's been effective. It's been passed from lip to ear over thousands of years. It has a herbal tradition. It has a historical perspective. Chiropractic manipulation is over 10,000 years old. It has withstood the test of time because, quite simply, it works. Now, we also have quite a bit of scientific data to support this concept. For instance, most patients, about 95%, according to most of the surveys in North America and Europe, first consult chiropractors for musculoskeletal pain, the majority of which is back pain or neck pain or headaches. This is really the core of chiropractic practice, and it's really now well supported by evidence that are well accepted within the medical profession. In fact, articles in the journals like the Journal of Family Practice and the Annals of Internal Medicine, which is the official publication of the American College of Physicians, are now encouraging physicians to actively refer patients to chiropractors who treat patients with conditions such as low back pain, neck pain, and headaches. The studies are extensive. The studies, by the way, in Britain, where Dr. Ernst is from, Dr. Mead is a world-renowned researcher, and he did the famous Mead study in the early 1900s in which he took a look at large numbers of patients that had back pain, low back pain, which is the most disabling injury that people have worldwide. It's the one that costs the work situation the highest amount of money. He looked at the phenomenon of low back pain, applied one group of people receiving hospital-based treatment, which include physical therapy, pain medication, exercises, and bed rest, the other group receiving chiropractic treatment. At the end of this exhaustive study, he found out something quite significant. Chiropractic manipulation was the most effective method of treatment and the most cost-effective method of treatment for people experiencing low back pain. Subsequently, Dr. Pragna, who's in Canada, did the famous MANGA study. And the MANGA study in Canada demonstrated the same thing. In fact, it found that chiropractic manipulation for back pain was more effective than any form of conventional or alternative form of treatment for the treatment of back pain. And so he recommended to the Ministry of Ontario that they begin adopting chiropractic treatment as the first line form of treatment for anyone who is experiencing back pain as the number one step. Subsequently, there have been studies by the RAND Corporation, which is a think tank in California. There's the famous Swedish study that was recently completed, the Duke University study, which was completed about 2 months ago, which found that chiropractic treatment is not only effective for back pain, but it's the most effective treatment for neck pain and headaches because most of them are purely mechanical. So adjustments of the spine are safe and effective. Now, Dr. Ernst, on the other hand, wants to bring to people's attention that chiropractic treatment may be effective for someone that acutely hurts their back. It's ineffective for people that have chronic pain, that it's not effective for people that have neck pain or headaches, and that there's a risk of receiving chiropractic manipulation and developing a stroke. This flies in the face of all of the current science, in which it's been demonstrated, for instance, that the risk of having a stroke from chiropractic adjustments to the neck area is less than going to your beautician and bending your neck back and having your hair washed. It's less than performing a yoga exercise. There's a greater probability statistically that you'd be struck by lightning. So that it's such a non-issue that patients receiving chiropractic adjustments do not have to sign a release form. So that we're really talking about an individual with a bias who's selectively looking at scientific information and unscientific information and then basically putting his spin or medical attitude on it. And I think that we now have a body of information in the scientific community, in the non-biased scientific community, that's recognizing that the various forms of alternative medicine, chiropractic manipulation, acupuncture, homeopathy, detoxification, various herbal medicines, intravenous forms of nutritional therapy, meditation, relaxation, prayer, ozone, play a very important and integral role in helping people get well. I was really struck, Gary, when you were talking earlier in the program about just some very simple basic things. You know, we often talk, because we're in the healthcare field as deeply as we are, about making major changes. But, you know, you can save a life, like you said, just by taking omega-3 fatty acids. You can improve the function of your brain by playing chess. You can take ginkgo biloba and slow down the process of nerve and neuronal degeneration in your brain so that you can think better and overcome a stroke at a more rapid rate. We need to integrate these various forms of therapy so that all of these various forms of therapy are available, so that we move away from the concept that one form of therapy is alternative and the other form of therapy is conventional, that conventional somehow is good, that alternative is somehow out of bounds or a little bit flaky, and begin to say that all of these forms of treatment play a role in helping the people get well, and that we need to continue to scientifically study them, but not study them from the point of view of creating a bias. There's quite a bit of bias in science.
There is a Dr. Eisenberg at Harvard Medical School has recently reported that complementary medicine is so widely used in the United States, it should be called conventional care, and that the most popular and widely used form of alternative medicine is chiropractic, followed by herbal medicine. And there is a scientific basis to chiropractic. And in fact, one of the most important studies on chiropractic care is a study that proved that even small subluxations or imbalances in the spine lead to chronic illness. And these type of subluxations are what chiropractic corrects. So the relevance of all this shows that those people who have attack chiropractic and other complementary care, including herbs, are doing so without either choosing to look at the other side of the story, or having looked, decide for their own biased reason not to report on it. And to help everyone in the field, what I'm doing now, and it will probably require another 6 months, possibly even longer, I'm collecting every study I can find in the worldwide literature from hard objective science proving the safety and efficacy of alternative therapeutic models, including nutrients, Currently, I have over 100,000 studies. I am databasing almost 1.5 million. When completed, it will be the most comprehensive single source on alternative referenced peer-reviewed literature in the world in existence. That once and for all, for those who are at least conscientious of being objective, will have all the data they need to support the therapeutic models they choose. I'm working on it. I've been working on it. I've been doing it as much as I can because I'm also finishing up some major investigations and documentaries. But it's getting done. So I want to thank you for coming on and challenging and offering the challenge again back to Dr. Ernst, as I had offered you an opportunity to do so. My guest, Martin Gallagher, and he is the author of Dr. Gallagher's Guide to 21st Century Medicine. Thanks a lot for being on today.
Thank you, Gary. I appreciate it.
Now, we're going to go over and say hello to our next guest who's going to talk about cancer and herbs. He is Michael Wald. And Michael, nice to have you back with us.
Nice to be here, Gary.
Michael, did you see 60 Minutes or hear about it?
I didn't.
Okay. Well, on this past Sunday, there were two women struggling to get an experimental drug that may or may not help them. There's no hard data on the drug. It's just another one of the so-called miracle chemotherapies that millions of people have died, literally millions, having used. And it's not the intent that I'm concerned with. I recognize the intent is a legitimate one. Yes, it's profitable, but it's also, it would be nice for these companies to make a profit and save lives. The trouble is very few lives are saved. What I want to do now is I want to show what other information exists. I have my own protocols that I have prepared. I must get, I'm going to guess, 10 calls or letters a day from mainstream Orthodox doctors who are simply out of hope. They've tried everything they can. Their patients are going to die. And so they say, what the heck, we'll give you, you know, one more shot. Well, it's interesting how many of those patients end up benefiting. And instead of going through my own particular protocol, which is extremely extensive, I'd like to first, and before we turn it over to you to give some herbs, I'd like to first try to let people know that there is a rationale for each thing that's created in a protocol. For example, if I suggested Ukraine at 5 to 20 milligrams every other day, or 714X, Carnivora, or Iscador, mistletoe, or Mignolin, or oxygenators like germanium and Koch's glycosides and Hoxie's herbs and Essiac and cat's claw and pancreatic enzymes. These are just not random substances you take one or two, just like N-acetylcysteine. There's a rationale behind it. Let me just give you an example. If I were to suggest to you, you should consider L-lysine. Why? Because people with cancer who receive amygdalin are going to have a higher requirement for this sulfur-containing amino acid to supply the sulfur necessary to convert cyanide found in amygdalin to a harmless compound called thiocyanate. And cysteine assists in various detoxification processes and reduces the toxic side effects of both chemotherapy and radiation. So if you've already had radiation, you've already had chemotherapy, you are toxic. These two therapies, even though they may kill cancer cells, also kill healthy cells and absolutely decimate the immune system. And what's the first organ that goes? Your liver. And where do you have to cleanse cancer cells out of the body? The liver. So supporting the liver is crucial. Then N-acetylcysteine. Now, cysteine needs may be met by N-acetylcysteine, since over 80% of the oral ingested dose of cysteine, but not N-acetylcysteine, is inactivated by stomach acid. Thus, N-acetylcysteine provides more precursor of the production of glutathione, which serves the key antioxidant system called the glutathione peroxidase. So you need, especially if you have malignant cancers, you need N-acetylcysteine, you need glutathione, you need cysteine, you need coenzyme Q10 or ubiquinone, and it protects against toxic chemotherapy. So there's where you could take both chemotherapy and have less of a toxic reaction because you're taking coenzyme Q10 at the same time, generally 300-400 milligrams. But people are not aware of this. And you'll say, well, the hoxie herb, hoxie was a quack. No, hoxie was not a quack. In fact, I've done an extensive study. I intend, at when time permits, which won't be this year, but I intend in time to do a very comprehensive documentary on hoxie. In fact, I've done my research on it. I was going to do it several years ago. But hoxie found that there were certain herbs, and he used them in what was called a potassium iodide tonic. And the herbs were red clover, buckthorn bark, burdock root, which, by the way, has very strong anti-mutagenic properties. Stalingia root, beriberis root, pokeberries root, and licorice root, and prickly ash bark. Now, each one of those in the pharmacopoeia can show anti-cancer or immune-enhancing properties. And when they were given, they made a big difference. In fact, one of the largest cancer hospitals in America for almost 15 years was using Hoxie's therapy down in Texas. The AMA and its rabid editor-in-chief, a man who was one of the most, clearly he was on his own obsessive-compulsive diatribe against Hoxie, because Hoxie had won in the court cases. In fact, the AMA actually had to admit that under oath in a court, interesting case, that his therapy did have anti-cancer properties. But this man, the man, by the way, who caused more women to smoke in America than any other human being, was the editor-in-chief of the Journal of the American Medical Association. And we should not forget the Journal of the American Medical Association, a little better than the National Enquirer, was the primary vehicle the tobacco industry used to get women to smoke. It, quote, it calmed their nerves. It was a good brain tonic. And so every doctor could say, calm your nerves, smoke. So millions of women began smoking to calm their nerves, not realizing that that's the last thing in the world that would have affected their nerves in a very destructive way. That's like saying, take opium, it'll calm your nerves. Well, sure it will. And that was one of the most popularly prescribed drugs of the 1800s. You go into any drugstore and get opium without a prescription. But that was for a specific condition called hysteria, a medical condition clearly defined by the greatest minds in American medicine and science, from Harvard to Columbia University. All of them could tell you all about hysteria. Did men suffer from hysteria? Not at all. It was a woman's disease. Only women suffer from hysteria. Remove the ovaries, cut off the clitoris, and give a woman opium. Perfect panacea. Well, of course, it was all wrong. Nobody apologized. So here you have a man named Hoxie who's doing some great work, and he's attacked mercilessly for 30 years because of this absolutely demented guy who ran the AMA. And of course, most of the people who run the AMA have had their own agendas. Well, Hoxie's herbs work. And when you study the actual pharmacology, you'll find the legitimacy for it. And then there's the maitake diffraction, the mushroom that has the strong life-enhancing properties. And it's very effective against cancer. But if you look in the scientific literature, you see the actual studies. You'll see it's there. It's not folk remedies. Cruciferous vegetables, broccoli, cauliflower. Juice them, yes. Take powders from them, even better. Eat them, okay. 2, 3, 4, 5 servings a day. Onions, yes. Sea vegetables, yes. All of these help in cancer treatment. Ginger, goldenrod, chamomile, passion flower, cucucha. But people are not using them because they don't know about them. And if they do have an inkling that they should use something, they're like Suzanne Summers, they may use one single thing. But we're talking about the metabolic detoxification in our system. Metabolic detoxing with enzymes. If I said, okay, before we go on this journey of healing, we first have to cleanse the system, and we're going to start with your gallbladder and your bile duct, and we're going to detoxify your liver, you'd go, what's that? Yeah, well, you got colorectal cancer. That was purely caused by your diet. Not having fiber, too much meat, dairy. Really? Yeah, that's what causes it. So we're going to give you milk thistle, and turmeric and ginger and dandelion. And we're going to stimulate the liver detoxification and balancing the proper flora. We're going to get rid of the local inflammation and destroy the free radical activity. And this is what you got to do. And we want to start with some enzymes like amylase and lipase and bromelain, which support that proper digestion. And we want to give you some superoxide dismutase and glutathione. And then they're going to look at you like you got three heads. They're going to go to their doctor and say, Gary Null suggested this amylase. He's going to say, what's that? And milk thistle couldn't be any good. Or germanium. Well, what's germanium? Well, try 500 milligram intravenous and see what it does to your natural killer cell activity. And so they're not going to know. Polypeptides, melatonin. Melatonin will stimulate interleukin 2. And thymus extract. The thymus gland is the activator of T lymphocytes. And the cells that play an essential role in the body's defense against cancer, as well as viral infections. And thymus produces some 60 different hormone-like proteins called peptides or polypeptides, which act as chemical messengers instructing T cells to fight cancer cells. So how can you possibly help a person with cancer without doing that? So I'm just giving you just an idea that it's a whole lot more than popping some pills. You have to understand what it is that your body is going through that created the cancer, and then you have to reverse the process and then undo the damage. And so when you do this, it can make a difference. Psycho-spiritual strategies, the meditation, the prayer, the visualization, the imagery, the neurolinguistic programming, the psycho-spiritual counseling, all of that helps. You got to work on it on every level. It's just not, again, popping pills. So, Michael, that said, and that's just on a scale of 1 to 100, that's a half of 1. Because the other 99.5 take time to explain so people understand what it is that something is doing. So it's not just giving someone some instructional piece of paper. It's giving them the understanding of how the body works and the markers and the antigen, the carcinoembryonic antigen test for colon cancer. I'll bet, you know, these people didn't even have that. And the alpha fetoprotein test for liver cancer, the primary hepatocellular carcinomas. And then letting them know, hey, here's your lymphatic system. Did you stimulate it today? Did you massage it today? Did you take certain herbs and juices to cleanse it, to purify it? No, the doctor said that my glands are swollen. We got to take them out. Take them out? If your septic system clogs up, which takes the debris out of your toilet, are you going to rip it out of the ground because it clogs up? Did your doctor ask you about how much sunlight you've been exposed to, the chronic electromagnetic field exposure you live around, work around, the geopathic stress, the sick building syndrome, the ionizing radiation, the pesticides and herbicides you may have used or been exposed to around your home, any industrial toxins, the water you drink is polluted, the chlorine in your water, the fluoride in your water, the hormone therapies you may be using, any immunosuppressive drugs, the irradiated food, your food addictions, your mercury toxicity in your teeth, your nerve interference fields, your nutritional deficiencies, the amount of fat, protein in your diet, the animal proteins, the chronic stress you're under, the depressed thyroid activity, the intestinal toxicity, the parasites, the viruses, the blocked detoxification pathways, the free radical pathology, the cellular oxidative deficiencies, the oncogenes, the genetic predisposition, the mysm. Have he discussed or she discussed this with you? No, they just said it was probably just genetic. He didn't talk about blocked detoxification pathways, that in a healthy individual, the body's normal detoxification system, especially the liver, are able to process and cleanse these toxins, including cancer, and help balance the immune system. But when it becomes blocked, then you're going to have an incapacity for the clogged lymphatic drainage system, which becomes thickened with lymph, accumulates dangerously in the lymph nodes without being emptied into the blood circulation for removal by the body. And You've got to get your enzymes working again. You got to understand metabolic overload, endocrine overload, free radical overload, immune overload, free radicals in relationship to cancer. Did they discuss this? Did they discuss cellular oxygenation deficiencies? The work of Dr. Otto Warburg, the two-time Nobel Prize winner. Nope. None of that. I see. How about the oncogenes and the tumor suppressor genes and their presumed cancers, the gliomas, brain cancers, glioblastomas? Nope. Okay. So now you know what people don't know. Now you know why you heard none of that on 60 Minutes. It's like a different world. And to go into that world, you have to be prepared to do your homework. You can't just be passive. You have to be extremely active. You have to take control over what you're willing to process. So then, when you hear, okay, you've got to start drinking green tea and grape juice made from whole grapes and heavenly aloes and the indocin and genistin and larch, you'll say, okay, I understand why. I understand what it's doing in my body. I understand what combinations, I understand in what regimens, I understand about IP6 and MGM3 and shark cartilage, and I understand it. Because right now, this is information the average American doesn't understand. The average man doesn't understand PCSPEZ, doesn't understand what it will do, shrinking the prostate gland. But people are not stupid. Give them a chance and watch how quickly they embrace this. So when I was watching 60 Minutes before my show, and at no time was there even a discussion, is there any other option? They kept saying, hopelessness, nothing would work. I tried everything repeatedly, cancer coming back. Doctor told me to go and put my life in order. I had 3 months to live. My husband and I were in shock. And then we heard about this one drug that was still being tested, and we thought maybe compassion usage, we could get it. And my goodness, at the very least, if this person were in one of our hands who knew what we were doing, a whole lot could change. Quality of life, getting the body cleansed, rebuilt, and stimulating the immune system, not even considered. Well, for those of you who are interested in considering these things, let's go back to Michael. Michael, that is an opening for you to take us on your journey now.
That is, it's one heck of an opening, Gary. I appreciate it. And you share the very same thoughts and concerns that I have. Among what you said that I think is very important to realize is that people do need to be proactive, and they need to trust that their body can heal, and that, yes, there may in fact be a time when we need to avail ourselves of standard conventional anti-cancer therapies like chemotherapy, radiation, or surgery. But this doesn't mean that we can't use nutrition to enhance those effects, to reduce the dosages of these toxic medications, and to clean up the mess once it's all gone. So that's some of what I'll discuss right now, among other specifics. I just want to quickly say, too, that different nutrients, and you mentioned a whole bunch of them, and we could literally go on for years discussing the amount of useful types of different nutrients, vitamins, minerals, foods, herbs, for example, that make a difference in cancer. But what's important to realize, too, is that when we say cancer, we're using this general term, which doesn't necessarily describe what's occurring in an individual. So in other words, cancer has to start, which is what's called initiation of that cancer, and then it has to promote itself. In other words, there has to be an immune system allowing these abnormal cells to copy themselves uncontrollably, and therefore that could lead to progression. So we have these stages: initiation, promotion, progression. And I want to define these things, because if you use these terms when you speak to your regular oncologist, they won't necessarily treat you like a fool or a passive participant in your own health. And from a nutritional practical point of view, different nutrients and herbs and foods may target better either the initiation stage or promotion or progression stage of cancer. And the other very important thing to realize is it's not that neat. In other words, someone may have an obvious tumor, which is obviously progressed and it's a cancer, but there may be, and there are, other areas of the body where there are cancers forming and that have been forming and are at various stages of development throughout the entire body. And the standard methods of evaluating an individual for their cancer may not pick up these things. An MRI, for example, or a mammogram may not pick up an abnormal cancer growth unless those cells have gone through hundreds of thousands of abnormal copying cycles until it's obviously visible. Long before that happens, we have to have problems with the immune system. The immune system is directly dependent on nutrition, not just what one's eating, but what one's absorbing. And then we have these unique differences for nutrition. So the nutritional support for someone's either cancer or their prevention of cancer, or how the nutrition will support or be an adjunct to regular cancer treatments, may vary among not just individuals, but within individuals over time, depending on their changing choices and things. So, again, we don't have time to get into the possible causes of cancer, but just let's suffice it to say for now that we know we have a genetic propensity for needing certain nutrients and for certain resiliency against our environment. So if our environment contains harmful chemical estrogens, for example, or pesticides and fungicides and herbicides, these are stresses on our immune system, which can result in not just cancer, but you name the degenerative disease, and it may not happen the day you're exposed or a week or a month or a year later, maybe 10 or 20 or 30 years later. So there's genetics, there's foods, there's the outward environment, like you said, Gary, electromagnetic and other current exposures, there's chemical exposures, there's problems with exercise and stress and metals. So these are all very important. But for now, why don't I speak about, I'd like to jump around and talk about some, not just herbs, but vitamins and minerals as well. And I want to relate it to some specific cancers too. And I know we don't have a lot of time, so I'm going to go through it quite quickly, and we can always give notes out and things like that. But very, very important. I had a person in just today, Gary, who had a lot of cancer in the family history, but his main concern was heart disease. But he's on Lipitor, which is a cholesterol-lowering drug, which lowered his cholesterol. But his homocysteine, which you've talked about in past shows, which is a marker of how much folic acid, B12 and B6 someone needs, was sky high. And what does that have to do with cancer? Well, we know that homocysteine can be high and predispose one to heart disease, but also to cancer, among other diseases, and they have similar nutritional deficiencies in common. Plus, he also has polyps in his colon. So what does all this mean? Well, we know that blood levels of folic acid are usually low when someone has polyps. Homocysteine being high means that someone needs folic acid, B12, and at least B6. And so we see how common nutritional problems may look like different things in different people. But to be specific, so with folic acid, for example, I think most of the research I've read in terms of folic acid has had to do with solid tumors, but also cervical cancers. Folic acid definitely plays a role in what's called the carcinogenic process. If you have a deficiency of folic acid, you affect your DNA. DNA is your genetic material, and then it copies abnormally. Sometimes, Gary, people actually have deficiencies of nutrients in local areas. So in other words, a woman with cervical cancer or a man with intestinal cancer or polyps, which is, of course, not cancerous but is also not normal, might need to have an enema that has folic acid. Or we might want to have a douche with folic acid and other herbs directly to the site of the problem, in addition to modifying the diet and taking other nutrients orally. So that's important to think about, too. So folic acid, he says, is very important. If someone has a high homocysteine, don't just think of heart disease. Think of folic acid. And if someone has cancer out there, you definitely want to think of that. There was a recent study in the New England Journal of Medicine, Gary, this was just a few months ago, that showed that someone might actually shrink their solid tumors if they consumed 25 milligrams of folic acid. Milligrams. We're not talking micrograms here. So some people are taking what they think is a lot. And that study was an intravenous study, so sometimes people need high doses in veins to make a real difference depending on the stage of their cancer. Lung cancer, also localized folic acid deficiency in the lungs predisposes to lung cancer. We know that smoking depletes folic acid and B12, and that's an obvious connection, but sometimes it's not quite so obvious. Vitamin B2, the lower the B2 in the blood, which is called riboflavin, the higher the colon cancer risk and the prostate cancer risk. So I'm just going to throw out a couple of these interesting connections. Vitamin A, particularly a breakdown product of vitamin A known as retinoic acid. This has been linked to a whole host of cancers, bladder cancer, colon cancer, cancers of the endometrium, the liver, the throat, what's known as the larynx, the lungs, the stomach. And I have studies, Gary, medical journal articles on every single thing that you and I are speaking about. So when we hear that there's no evidence for these things, unfortunately we're dealing with, I think, well-intentioned standard medical oncologists, but they just don't know this stuff, and or they've convinced themselves that they can't integrate and or even recommend some of these things to people. So that's where we need to be proactive. Vitamin B6. We need vitamin B6 to work with enzymes in the body. A deficiency of vitamin B6 causes a problem with the production of something called thymidine in the body, which is known to increase what's called mutagenesis. That's abnormal cellular copying. Again, linked to a whole bunch of different types of cancers, particularly solid types of tumors. So someone might say, well, okay, doc, they say to their doctors, well, you know, I heard about this vitamin B6, so the doctor will measure their blood levels of B6, and it could be normal. A doctor would say, well, I told you that had nothing to do with it, but they might have high homocysteine, which is B6 dependent. Or we realize that we may not have to have abnormal blood levels of something. Well, if you have an obvious cancer, you know, we're not at the epitome of science that blood testing is necessarily going to reveal everything that we need. So we take things that are safe. They're far safer than the prevailing methods of treatment today. Vitamin C. There is strong evidence from many studies that vitamin C level is inversely correlated with cancer risk in general. In other words, the lower your vitamin C intake, the higher your cancer risk from a number of different cancers. There were specific studies that were extremely convincing with gastric cancer in particular, and also increasing one's chances of developing what's known as Helicobacter pylori in the gut. And most of us know about Helicobacter as this bacteria, which is the cause of ulcers. At least that's what it's touted as. Which really confuses me, Gary, because most people with ulcers do not have Helicobacter pylori. And even if they did, we need to ask the question, why do we have this Helicobacter pylori? It didn't come out of nowhere. It resulted in abnormally proliferated out of control when the immune system, the digestive tract, was exposed to stressors. And then it grows. If someone happens to have an ulcer and they measure Helicobacter, they're like, that's the cause. And then what's the treatment? Obviously, the person's antibiotic deficient because that's the prevailing treatment, which doesn't answer the problem and doesn't increase the health of the person. So now they're on antibiotics, which screw up the gut even more. They don't absorb well. Now they'll be further nutritionally deficient, and they may not have their ulcers anymore, but and they're thinking they're fine in every other way. So this is the type of thinking that we're dealing with. Vitamin C, I wanted to say a few more things about that. Vitamin C reduces the formation of things called nitrosamines, and these are from dietary sources with foods that have nitrites and nitrates in them, and it reduces the carcinogenic effects of these chemicals and could be taken, like if someone's stuck out and they have to, you know, have lunch at one of these salad bars, which are usually sprayed with this stuff, at least if you take some vitamin C, you're going to cut down the carcinogenic effects of that upon the body. And the amounts of vitamin C, and you know, you spoke earlier, Gary, about how vitamin C can be used in those who choose to do, let's say, chemotherapy or standard therapies. Vitamin C is proven to enhance the effects of a variety of chemotherapeutic agents. Some of the common ones used. So, again, I hear an awful lot from patients that they say that my oncologist said that this will somehow reduce the effectiveness of my chemotherapy or radiation. Nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, abnormal cells don't tend to take up nutrition very well, but the healthy cells do. So we can be protecting the healthy cells from the harmful and damaging effects of chemotherapy and radiation, and we might also get the benefit of reducing the amount of chemotherapy or radiation needed with nutrients like vitamin C. The same has been shown for glutathione, which you mentioned and we'll speak about in a minute. Vitamin D is also very important, particularly for colorectal cancers and also breast cancer. So exposure to sunlight is, of course, important, and we may not have enough sunlight. Many of us we might get enough sunlight. And when I've interviewed people about this, a person will say to me, "Yeah, well, I have breast cancer, and I spent lots of time on the beach, and I should make plenty of vitamin D, so I don't understand it." And then you question them, and you find out as soon as they get home, they take their showers, washing a lot of that vitamin D produced in the skin clean off. So it's just a very interesting observation. But vitamin D should be part of anyone's anti-cancer program, not only just treatment, but prevention.
Michael, what I want to do is this. We don't have time to go through, I'm sure, all the different things you want to do. I would rather set that time aside so you can come back and do it in more depth so we can have you back for a follow-up on this. All right? Michael Wald, talking about the first steps in protecting yourself from cancer, of course, and if you should have cancer, what might be some of the underlying causes and strategies for helping it. And I will continue. I tend to do about 4 programs on herbs and cancer. This is just the opening slot to let you know some of the things we're not paying attention to. And by the way, I am sending today's program to the two women to see if they and their husbands are interested in at least examining this, in which case I will certainly be happy to explore some of the alternatives with them. We do not have a service at this time for people to get any tapes of the show, but when we do, and we're seeking one out now, I'll be able to let you know what that is. In the interim, just take down the show numbers each day, and then you'll be able to get them later on. Today's show number is 2754. Our office number, our new office number, is 646-505-4660. 646-505-4660. And good news is, because we hear so much bad news, that finally, for all of you who have been, I mean, thousands and thousands of people over the last 2 years who've been contacting my office about where do you go for this, or where do you go for, you know, counseling and therapies for cancer, heart disease, whatever. And I cannot qualify a referral. I could only suggest certain people. But now there is a place that I have personally interviewed everyone in great depth who are going to be using really good holistic protocols. And it's the Metropolitan Wellness Group. They're on 31 East 28th Street. And let me give you the number, because this is for everyone who needs help. 212-252-1942. 212-252-1942. And they're at 31 East 28th Street, the Metropolitan Wellness Group. So now, finally, you ask, there's a place, and it can help people. I'll see you tomorrow. Have a nice day.